Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the LBT Innovations quarterly investor call. All participants are in a listen-only mode, so be rest assured that nobody else on the call will be able to see or hear you. There'll be a presentation followed by a question and answer session that I will announce at the end of the presentation. To ask a question, please use the Q&A box on the Zoom control panel, or feel free to raise your hand to ask your question in person. Unfortunately, those joining by telephone only will not be able to raise a question. I would now like to hand over the conference to Mr. Brent Barnes, CEO and Managing Director.
Thank you, Jack, and welcome everyone. Thanks for joining this quarterly investor call today. I hope you're all keeping well, and I'm pleased to be providing today's company update. The call today will follow the usual format. I'll first talk through the company's activities for the past quarter, followed by our CFO, Ray Ridge, who will take us through our financials for the period. And then finally, I'll provide an overview of the future outlook and expected activities for the upcoming quarter. We'll finish the session with questions and answers. An audio of today's call will be made available on our website later today. Now I'd like to introduce our Chief Financial Officer, Ray Ridge.
Thanks, Brent. Just the usual formality before we commence. I would like to remind those on today's call that the update may contain forward-looking statements which involve inherent risks and uncertainties. And those risks and uncertainties include those disclosed in our ASX lodgements, which we recommend that you review. There are reasonable grounds for any forward-looking statements made today. However, due to their inherent uncertainties, we recommend that you do not place undue reliance on those statements, and actual results may differ materially from those forward-looking statements. We're ready to go. Back to you, Brent.
Great. Thanks, Ray. Over the past quarter, the company has been working hard to advance and progress our strategy for commercialization of the APAS Independence. I will begin by running through our ongoing product development and game plan to increase the availability of the APAS technology for our customers. For a long time now, I have described the importance of building a menu of analysis modules for different specimen types for the APAS Independence. This is a crucial activity for the company, as each analysis module serves to increase the value proposition of the APAS instrument for our customers and enables us to expand the overall market opportunity. Increasing analysis modules will be a key factor in addressing more of our customer needs and expanding the revenue opportunity for each instrument sold. We have a detailed schedule of planned analysis modules to be developed for the key markets of the US and Europe, with their respective major media in use, all aimed at making the instrument more attractive to the wider universe of target labs. On this front, we made some important steps forward for this quarter. Firstly, we developed a process for releasing early evaluation versions of these analysis modules for customers. This enables new lab sites to evaluate the instrument and provide early customer feedback prior to having a fully regulatory cleared module available. This was a process we executed with the Doctors Laboratory in the UK as they trialled our European urine analysis module, and we believe will be an important factor when making their final purchasing decision. Their feedback has been integrated into our product development process and will support the final release for that module. This is a process we intend to continue to replicate for new customer evaluations. For our VRE and MRSA analysis modules, we move closer to having regulatory cleared analysis modules available for both the EU and the US. Both modules are complete from a product development perspective, and we are currently working through the final stages to obtain regulatory clearances. The data collection for the VRE clinical study has now been completed, and we are in the process of analysing the results prior to completing our CE mark registration for that module. Turning to the MRSA analysis module for the US market, this remains with the FDA for review, and pleasingly, we've had some positive dialogue with the FDA during the quarter. We remain confident of a positive outcome for this module and would like to remind shareholders that this module is already CE marked and we have positive clinical data reported, from the prestigious Johns Hopkins Hospital, obviously based in the US. Now moving on to commercialization and sales activities for the period, where we've seen a number of key opportunities progress. Our long-stated strategy for sale of the APAS Independence has been to establish partnerships with leading, high-credentialed distributors in regions outside of Australia. The cost and time to develop our own direct sales channels is just not practical. Therefore, these channel partners offer the opportunity to scale our sales efforts, and we benefit from their deep customer networks and many years of industry experience. Customers build trust with people, and moreover, the associated company or the brand that those people represent. Partnering with companies like Beckman Coulter in Europe is an example of a trusted brand that has been selling into labs for over 40 years. Customers come to trust that brand through the products they offer and service that they provide, which is why companies have such an extensive process to review new technology before they put their name to it. In the US, we've been working through such process with a number of potential distribution partners over the last 12 months, with activity really ramping up over this past quarter. We are currently undergoing a detailed due diligence process across several streams of activity that include contract negotiations. While at this stage I can't name the parties involved, I can say that each potential partner offers a great commercial fit for the APAS Independence, and we are close to realising our distribution goals for the US market. I hope to bring you more on this in the near term. In Europe, we have already seen early benefits from our marketing partnership with Beckman Coulter. Despite increased travel restrictions in Europe during the COVID-19 pandemic over the last 18 months, with cross-border travel restrictions in place in the UK, France and Germany, we have still had Beckman Coulter's local sales teams on the ground in each of those countries. This has enabled us to engage with many more laboratories than we would have been able to do on our own. In March, we completed our first in-person joint customer visit in France, which will be our first installation and evaluation site for the APAS Independence under the Beckman Coulter agreement. Apart from our distribution partnerships, we also maintain a direct market presence in Australia, Europe and the US through our own sales executives in each region. They also provide us direct market feedback and a nimble sales presence to target near-term opportunities. While sales progress has been slower than we anticipated, our sales team continue to focus on technology innovators as potential early adopters and customers for our technology. From a sales perspective, we didn't deliver the number of sales that we expected during the quarter and continue to refine our go-to-market strategy to improve timelines and outcomes. This has reinforced the importance of having well-motivated distributors for the APAS Independence that will ultimately accelerate adoption for the technology. Before handing over to Ray, I would like to provide a quick update on our board rejuvenation process and new board policy for directors to purchase shares. The board process is progressing with an external recruitment company working to support the replacement for the chair position. We have received interest from a number of highly qualified individuals with the board working through interviews as a priority. As previously reported, our long-standing non-executive director, Caroline Popper, will retire from the board later this month, and a replacement director for this role will occur following the appointment of the new chair. We have taken on board feedback from shareholders in relation to directors holding shares. Whilst we understand there is a preference for on-market purchase of shares, as a relatively small listed company, there are often long periods where directors are restricted from doing so due to insider trading restrictions. This new board policy provides a routine mechanism for board members to accumulate shares during their tenure at market rates with minimal dilution to shareholders. It also does not exclude opportunities for directors to also purchase additional shares on market in accordance with our share trading policy. Importantly, the policy is in place for all future directors of the company and will serve as an important mechanism to strengthen alignment between the board and our shareholders. I'd now like to hand it over to Ray to talk through our financials for the quarter.
Thanks, Brent. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I will now turn to an overview of the financial results as reported in the Appendix 4C lodged with the ASX. These numbers are all in Australian dollars and in accordance with ASX listing rules are not audited. So for the quarter ended 31st of March, LBT reported net cash outflows from operating and investing activities of 0.6 million. This included an inflow of 0.9 million from the company's R&D tax incentive. So removing that, we were consistent with our long held run rate of approximately 1.5 million per quarter. Net cash outflows from financing activities of 0.2 million, which was the quarterly repayment under the SAFA facility. This provided total net cash outflows for the quarter of 0.8 million, which resulted in a cash balance of 11.2 million at the end of March. Back to you, Brent.
Thanks for that, Ray. Now looking at the business outlook. The activities over the past quarter have set the company up for a pivotal 6 months ahead. Finalising a distribution partnership in the US remains a number one priority, and I'm confident we will achieve this important milestone before the end of the third quarter. Our sales teams will remain focused on converting current opportunities, such as the Doctors Laboratory in the UK and SA Pathology here in Australia. We also have new evaluation commencing in both France and the United States. The opportunity in France is particularly exciting as it will be the first installation of the instrument alongside Beckman Coulter's AutoPlaque instrument for plate streaking, and will be a great proof point for this combined technology offering. As mentioned, we've also made great strides from a technology perspective. In Europe, we expect to release our VRE analysis module in the third quarter of this calendar year, shortly followed by a European urine module at the end of the year. In the US, we expect to have a conclusion from the US FDA on our submission for our MRSA analysis module in the third quarter of this year, and will then shift our focus to expanding the number of media supported by our US urine analysis module. Combined, these efforts will offer a much greater value proposition for the instrument, enabling us to meet the requirements of many more of our customers. This, coupled with major sales partners in both the US and Europe, will place the company in a position to deliver on much more of the potential market opportunity for the technology. Finally, the team here in Adelaide will also be coming together into a single company office. Over the past few years, we've been separated by two offices due to the limitations of finding a location that had a laboratory facility that could also fit all of our staff. Later this month, we'll combine both offices and expect this will bring increased productivity between our teams who operate very, very closely together across multiple disciplines. We look forward to hosting those shareholders who are based in Adelaide or want to travel to Adelaide at our new facility once we've settled in sometime over the coming months. I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to attend today's session, and would now open the line up to any questions.
Thank you, Brent. We will now commence the question and answer session. Please remember, if you would like to ask a question, either use the Q&A function on the Zoom control panel at the bottom of your screen, or raise your hand and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request at any time, simply remove the raised hand. The first question comes from Liam Mahoney.
Yeah, g'day there, Brent.
Morning, Liam.
Yeah, I've got a question in regards to sort of how can...
I'm not hearing you, Liam, so I don't know whether you're on mute.
Shouldn't be. Is that better? Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's coming through now.
Yeah, sweet, cool. Yeah, g'day, Brent. Just wanted to know how you and the board can assure the shareholders that you won't be further diluting the share price through additional capital raises, especially on, you know, potentially positive news later on the year, because we've had 4 years where we've pretty much had a capital raise on the back of any sort of positive news. I'm just sort of wanting to know, does the board have any measures to bring in sort of positive cash flow as opposed to just from capital raises, potentially through government grants or something along the lines of that?
Yep. I understand where you're coming from there, Liam. So I think probably the headline there to start off with is the fact that we've got $11.2 million in the bank. So we obviously did raise capital last year. We are sitting with a very healthy bank balance at the moment, and we're burning, you know, around $6 million per year. Any sales, obviously, that we're able to generate during that time further increases our financial position and our runway. We have been beneficiaries of government grants before. We obviously have the SAFA loan facility that's in place. That's that $4 million facility that we were awarded. We've also been beneficiaries of the recent MTP Connect government grant, which is about $750,000 of funding. So I can absolutely assure you that from a funding and from an inflow perspective, the company is always looking at those non-dilutive opportunities to bring money into the business in ways that like I said, is non-dilutive for shareholders.
Yeah, sweet. No, thanks for that, Brent. I do have a couple more questions, but I'm not sure if you want pass on to somebody else. Or, okay, yeah. So I've got my second question is just sort of wanted to know why directors are going to extreme lengths to avoid having any skin in the game with purchasing shares from LBT. I know that you did say that there are periods that, you know, due to ASX regulation, you can't buy because it can be potentially deemed as insider trading. But in particular, I know that Damien has the minimum amount of shares that the LBT constitution requires for a director to have. And Simon, who essentially now represents one third of the board and has been on the board for 18 months, still hasn't put a single cent into purchasing any shares, which, you know, I would say violates that constitution pretty greatly. And we're talking from a position where, you know, the share price is at 8 cents, where, you know, it's lower than any other capital raise we've had. It's at a lower point from the last four AGMs. And, you know, it's the lowest point of the share price after the first strike. So, yeah, I'm just sort of wanting to know what the board thinks about that, because from an outside perspective, I think just looking into a company which looks like it is slowly slipping down and the directors are avoiding buying in, it doesn't really inspire any confidence for a shareholder or a potential shareholder.
Yep. I understand where you're coming from in terms of the question. Probably the best way I can answer that is that there are extended periods where directors have insider information that the market obviously doesn't have knowledge about. And as a small company, that materiality, I guess, is more highly scrutinised. And so I'd say that, look, the directors are not going out of their way not to buy shares on market. Clearly, the current share price is at a horribly low level. No one's happy with where that sits. But, you know, I think what we've tried to really do with this policy perspective is mandate or put in place a systematic mandated process for all directors to acquire shares. And so that's in place. It's instituted. It's there for Simon. It's there for Damien. It'll be there for the new chair. It'll be there for the new non-executive director coming in that will replace Caroline when that occurs. I understand kind of where you're coming from and the perception. All I can say is there are open and closed periods. We can't tell the market when those open and closed periods are, but we have put in place a policy that does absolutely address the fact that by, I guess, definition of their employment, they will be required to take shares in the company during their tenure.
Yeah, cool. No, thanks for that. Just one more follow-up on, I believe it was the quarterly, there was a sentence in there that was talking about how there's a potential another sale to the Halo Lab in the UK and further talks with, I believe it was the Limbach Group. I just sort of wanted to know what's sort of the nature of those talks with the company. Are they sort of semi-regular? Is it predominantly they're waiting on, you know, I know the UK is still in a pretty dire COVID situation. So is that sort of being brought up, the fact that, you know, COVID is happening and they don't really have enough staff to install new machines, or sort of what's, I suppose, the nature of those talks to the Halo and that sale to the Limbach group?
Yes, I'll start with the Halo. So the Halo, we kind of said, had finished the MRSA evaluation at the end of December. That was all positive, and kind of led to them wanting to then look at urines for performing urine screening. So that also completed in the first quarter. And those results are really positive. So I guess what I can say is that we are working through a process with that group in London. Absolutely, COVID has an impact around kind of labs adopting new technology, having the time, having the budget and all of these things. But I can say that the results that we've shared with shareholders publicly, and in fact, the lab itself have kind of been interviewed previously, that we've put out saying that they, you know, they really like the instrument and it delivers what they intended, what they expected the instrument to do, are all really positive signs. So we're working through a process with them. On the Limbach group, so this is the group in Ravensburg that we sold an instrument to at the end of last year. So they're part of a chain of private labs throughout Germany, the Ravensburg location being the first one, and their head office is in a place called Heidelberg. The nature of the discussions or the focus there is really Jan, our European sales executive, working really closely with the Ravensburg lab at the moment to support getting their lab information system connected, getting it up and running routinely. They're using it at the moment routinely for their MRSA screening, but it's not connected to the LIS yet. So this is an activity that that is, you know, on them, and it's on their IT group. But really, that's an important connectivity issue that we're trying to the best we can to support, and obviously provided all of the information that we can. But really, that's kind of, it needs to be connected to the LIS before other parts or other groups or labs within the network really take a serious look at it.
Yeah, cheers for that, Brent. I'll just lower my hand and let other, I suppose, shareholders ask a couple of questions if they have any. So cheers for that.
Thank you, Liam. Your next question comes from Henry McQuinn.
Morning, gents. How are you doing?
Going well.
Good. Look, you sound very confident, Brent, about this distributor deal in the US. Can you expand on that a little bit and give us some colour on your expectations?
Yeah, look, I am confident, so I'm glad you picked that up in my tone. We've been working with a number of groups for 12 months, and we've known them for longer than 12 months. I think the other part of it is we've obviously gone through a similar exercise of due diligence with Beckman Coulter, and that took, you know, a long period of time, but nevertheless, we have a really good handle of what's needed. We have clarity around what the process is and the interdependencies, and I would say it's a pretty high effort set of activities that the team have been working on in the background. So it hasn't resulted, I guess, in a successful milestone in the quarter, but there's been quite a lot of activity that the team have been working with these counterparts, and we're doing it, you know, not just with one, it's with more than one. And so that kind of duplicates some of that effort. And that's why I kind of say it's a high effort activity. So it's clearly an important milestone for the company and sets us up really to scale the US market. But I think for those variety of reasons around having experience, having done it with Beckman, we've been working for, you know, kind of 12 months now. There's really aligned synergies with expectations with these stakeholders. So yeah, I am quite confident around an outcome before the end of the third quarter.
Okay, nice one. Thank you. And just another question, if I may. I see that Australian Clinical Labs is IPOing on the ASX soon after being in private equity hands for some time. Do you think there's the potential for any opportunity there with time?
Yeah, absolutely, Henry. So we've had an instrument placed at ACL here in Adelaide, and they've actually published a paper, which is a successful paper outlining their experience using the instrument. And we think APAS would be a really great instrument for the Adelaide lab, but also for a number of their labs. They are They are a private equity group, as you mentioned, and there's in the news there's been talk of them being for sale, and now they're IPOing. But look, we remain in contact with ACL, and they've already had experience using the instrument. That experience has been really positive, but clearly there's some other probably pressing priorities for them in the near term anyway, as they look to get things up and running.
Okay, Beaut. Thank you.
Thanks, Henry.
Thank you. And now we have a couple of questions that have come in through the Q&A panel. So I will go through those quickly. The first one is from an anonymous attendee. Will there be any incentives combining both offices?
I guess one of the positive things around COVID and working from home is that the office kind of space environment's been one that's pretty competitive. So we've been able to, I guess, secure a fantastic office that that is equivalent. You know, we're not going to save significant costs. So there's going to be some efficiencies there, but we're bringing everyone together under one roof. And we've been able to negotiate a really positive deal with the landlord there. It's very close by to our current office here in Adelaide in the CBD. But we're really looking forward to bringing both teams together and generating the efficiencies we absolutely expect by having our microbiology or our science team together with our software engineering and AI team. So all of those kind of groups under the one roof will really help from a technology product development perspective.
And then we have a couple of questions about the sales activity and prospects in Australia.
Yeah, well, Henry just mentioned the Australian Clinical Laboratories, and so that's one I've already commented on. And look, they've had an instrument that's been successful. I would say that around the public hospitals, which is, you know, there's many public hospitals around Australia, they go through a tender process. There haven't been any tenders released for microbiology automation in the last 4 years. So, you know, it's pretty slow. That's not to say we're not talking with various stakeholders. I met with someone, with a number of people actually in hospitals in Sydney a number of weeks ago, and that engagement remains ongoing. And so, look, we talk across the hospital network in all states and territories, but it is a process determined by tender, and it's one, like I said, where we haven't had a tender released for automation and microbiology, and it kind of keeps getting pushed out 1 year, 1 year, 1 year. So there's some work being done around the requirements, but it's very difficult to have a line of sight into when those will actually drop.
A question from David Mackay. When do you predict you will become cash flow positive on sales?
Maybe I'll flick that one to Ray, our CFO.
Thanks, Brent. Thanks for the question, David. Look, that's a really difficult one because I guess, number one, it depends on sales, and we've been very mindful of not putting sales forecasts out there because of the long sales cycle and the status of engaging distributors. So it's very difficult to answer that question. I guess on the other side of it as well is the cost base. You know, it is quite intensive, quite high at the moment because we're very much still in development phase of developing these analysis modules that will open up future markets. So, and I guess to answer fully, the third aspect that complicates it a bit as well is taking into account in the revenue model the build-up of units in the market and that recurring income that comes in from the license fees. So, sorry, I couldn't answer your question very specifically to give you a number, but that's certainly some of the aspects of it. Thank you, Brent.
Yeah. And a further question about how we will support US distributors once appointed.
Yeah, so we've already got a US-based sales executive, and so they've been they're based in California. They've been on the ground for a bit over a year now. And principally, look, we've got someone on the ground there to support. And in fact, they're also supporting kind of these discussions we're having with distributors prior to having an established agreement. But similar to what we've got in Europe, we've got a single person there. We are going to have a single person in the US. We don't want to build up a sales presence and have that high cost base. We really want the distributor to be the arms and the legs. They're the ones who've got the feet on the ground. and these sales executives do a couple of things. They support our distributors, they support that channel, hold them to account, but also not losing sight of the fact that we will maintain some direct customer presence. So we look to appoint a distributor. We've already got, I guess, the mechanisms in place with people on the ground in the US market already. So we're not just, I guess, going blindly into the US and letting the distributor take complete control. We will have a lot of diligence and oversight in supporting them to be successful, which obviously supports us.
And now we're running out of time on this call, so we'll go to one last question from in person. So we'll hand over to Min if you'd like to ask your question.
Morning, Brent.
Morning.
So the quarterly report stated that a review of the sales and marketing strategy has taken place, taking on market feedback and learnings. What has been that feedback from potential customers, and what are those learnings?
Yeah, so what we looked at is, look, how are we looking at the market, how are we looking to engage with potential customers, and how are we segmenting our customer base, and what is that acquisition of new customers that we're looking at? Probably the key thing that's come out of that review is looking at further segmenting our customers through our CRM tool, looking to identify those Glenn Hansons, those Hilmar Wisplinghoff, those Lisa Brentons. We've got some early adopters, if you like, of the technology. We know that not every customer wants to be the first or the first group of people to adopt new technology. And so where we've pivoted, and it has been successful already in getting a placement into a lab on the west coast of the US, is looking for those customers who I describe have customer pull, meaning they're motivated, they want to make a difference, they want to do publications, but they're motivated by new technology. And I think that's really important, because in some respects where the technology is very much plug and play, but we're still asking the customer who's busy doing their business as usual day-to-day work to bring the instrument in, to allocate resources, to do an evaluation, and that all takes time. And, you know, one of the benefits and one of the needs, if you like, for the instrument is that labs don't have a lot of time. And so we need to invest our time and our activities with customers who are also motivated in wanting to generate that customer pull. So we're working with them in an aligned fashion. So that was probably the key insight out of that that process.
Yeah. Just another one quickly. I thought in the last quarterly it was mentioned that the FDA was looking to finalise its approval by the end of May, which now seems to be pushed out to Q3. Is there any reason for that? And do you remain as confident as ever that that will go through?
Yeah, so the May date was kind of the date that the FDA had set to have everything all in place and to kind of get back to us for review. I guess what the company is, we're just being a bit careful in the guidance. Look, the FDA have quite publicly put out communication to say that they will prioritise all things related to COVID applications ahead of anything else. And, you know, we're kind of part of that anything else, and we've already been delayed. So we have not had the benefit of having our typical interactive review process with the FDA as we normally would have done. And so what we're saying is that the information's been put forward. We remain highly confident in the outcome. But, you know, in the end, the FDA need to prioritise our submission relative to others. And you know, we see some risk there, I guess, that we're not going to have an outcome by the end of the second quarter and saying, look, it may move into the third quarter. So that's kind of the reason there. But look, we are, to the second part of your question, this module works really well. We've already CE marked it. It's in routine use at Hilmar Wisplinghoff in Europe. It's in routine use at Ravensburg, that Limbach group I mentioned earlier. We've had an extensive clinical evaluation done at Johns Hopkins Hospital. The data is really, really solid. And so we remain really positive around a successful outcome as we work through a process with the FDA.
And thanks, Brent. I'll just grab you one more quick question. Just on the board rejuvenation process, you mentioned that briefly earlier and some interested parties in that. So have we actually conducted any interviews with shortlisted candidates as yet, and how is that progressing?
Yeah, so we've had a there's a number of Firstly, we've appointed an external firm to help us do the headhunting. They've conducted a number of screening and interviews. We've had some really good interest, and we've gone through a process where we've had a look at a list and called out, you know, a double-digit kind of number of lists. We've cut that down, or the board's gone through a process of identifying a short list of people that we're working through an interview process with those people at the moment.
Thanks, Brent.
Thank you.
Thank you. There's no more time for additional questions, so that does conclude our conference for today. If you wish to send in any questions that you would like answered, please send them to info@lbtinnovations.com. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.